On Tech News Today, Facebook wants you to stop oversharing. Wait, what? Plus, Google details how they provide the world's fastest Netflix connections, and Apple finally gets the message about their iMessage bug. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, May 22nd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by RingCentral, the cloud-based phone system we use here at Twit. And it just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial. Buy one desk phone, get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is David Berlind, editor-in-chief at Programmable Web. Welcome, David.
Be back. Love coming on.
It looks like you're coming to us from the space station. That's quite a background. It's quite cosmic.
Yeah, well, actually, what's left of the space station, because, you know, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock destroyed it in that movie. So I'm just floating in space, as you can see.
Well, it's quite...
I'll try not to have too much fun
right
with your green screen, okay?
A new show a galaxy far, far away. Awesome. Well, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much.
Right to the news. Facebook is trying harder to keep people from accidental sharing, and they're doing it in two ways. Today, Facebook changed the default setting for new users. Instead of sharing to the public by default, posts will now be addressed to friends. If you don't have any friends, I guess it just goes to yourself. And Facebook is also getting help from a cartoon dinosaur. The Wall Street Journal's Reed Albergati is here to explain. Welcome, Reed.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, he's joining us by phone. Now, Reed, who is Privosaurus Rex? And what does he want?
That is, I actually came up with that name. So Facebook doesn't call him Privosaurus Rex. That's my pet name. He's a little blue cartoon dinosaur. And a couple months ago, people started getting, you know, these blue dinosaurs popping up on their screens, and the dinosaur was asking them to say, "Hey, look out, guys! You know, you're posting publicly. That means the entire world can see what you're writing." So we just want to make sure that you've got the right settings on and all that sort of things. And what they're doing now is rolling out that blue dinosaur to really everyone on Facebook, or at least that's the goal, all over the world. It's being translated to other languages. So it's been received well, and Facebook is, you know, making this kind of privacy awareness push in a bigger way.
Facebook's form of Clippy, is that it?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, they've been bleeding. Facebook has been famously bleeding users to services like Snapchat and so on. Does Facebook think that one of the reasons is that people at some point discover that they're oversharing, freak out, and then go to a place that's more private?
I think you put it really well. They are worried about that. I think they see that you know, people do make mistakes on social media. And, you know, they want people to be a little bit more mindful, and they think by doing that, they can reduce that attrition that comes from, you know, just these kind of freakouts that people have after doing something they didn't mean to do or making a bad decision on social media.
I thought it was a nightclub mentality that was causing that. You know, the cool place opens up, so all the cool kids go there, you know, because the adults are showing up at the old, you know, the old place. That's what happened at Facebook, right? I mean, you're there, Mike. I'm there.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook has a problem with that, especially with the young teen users. You know, privacy completely aside, you know, Facebook's where, you know, the average age keeps going up. It's where adults are. It's where corporations are. And those aren't usually where kids want to be. And so that's a big question for the future of Facebook. When those kids grow up, will they go on to Facebook? Will they use Facebook more? Or will they just stay with the programs that they're using now, like Snapchat and, you know, other apps?
Well, there are all kinds of ways to overshare and unintentionally share things on Facebook.
for example, one can post pictures for years and years and years and never really think about the fact that anybody can just search for the search string, you know, photos of so-and-so, and you get all of them in your search string, even if you're not necessarily following that person. And one of the ones that you mentioned was the fact that people share lots of data via apps that they install using the login. In fact, you suggest in your piece that that the dinosaur could that Facebook's whole process of having logins could lead to a rude awakening, and the dinosaur will expose this rude awakening as it takes you through and shows you what sorts of data you're sharing with what kinds of apps. So what kind of information are people sharing that they don't know about that will lead to this rude awakening?
What this dinosaur is going to do is show you really a list of every app that you have linked with your Facebook. So whether that's Spotify or just some random app that you downloaded a year ago and forgot about. And you can do this now. You can go onto Facebook and you should try it, actually. I did it. I hadn't done it in a while, and I realized, oh, I'm actually sharing a lot of stuff with apps I never use. But this will bring it to the front of people's minds. And if you click on the little pencil mark, which allows you to kind of change it, you don't have to actually completely disconnect from these other apps to change the settings. You can actually say, I want to stay connected to this app through with Facebook login, but I don't want to share, you know, my friend list and that sort of thing. And I think that's part of it's not Facebook saying we don't want your data anymore. It's saying here's a way to stop your data from being shared with third parties.
Does it tell you when the NSA is snooping in on your stuff?
you're gonna have to ask Facebook about that. I mean, they do disclose some of the NSA stuff, but there's no NSA dinosaur yet.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Facebook dinosaur doesn't have the security clearance to know what the NSA is doing on Facebook.
Yeah, but Zuckerberg certainly had words for Obama about that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think what you're talking about here is something I've addressed with Facebook. I said, look, you need to come up with some more cartoon, you know, fictional or prehistoric reptiles here. I mean, the Privatosaurus Rex is not enough.
Absolutely. Well, Reed Albergati, I want to thank you for phoning in to Tech News today and telling us about these new changes at Facebook.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. You can find Reed Albergati's work at WSJ.com, of course, and on Twitter at Reed Albergati. Well, in just a sec, we're going to tell you about Google's new kind of information around Google Fiber, which we don't have here, but we definitely want. Unfortunately, it's not here yet. But first, I want to tell you about RingCentral. RingCentral is a cloud-based phone system, and in fact, it's the one that we use here at Twit. And when Leo set up the studio here, he didn't want to build an old and busted PBX system. I've seen PBX systems in operation, and they are no picnic. I can tell you, the cloud is the right place for a phone system. And, of course, RingCentral is the best kind of cloud phone system you can find. They do all kinds of great stuff for us here. They enable us to send and receive faxes from our smartphones. Don't actually have to use a fax machine. There's something, a feature called the auto receptionist, who greets callers and announces employees and does department extensions. And that's a person that doesn't have to be paid to do that. Of course, it's all automated. And of course, they have a new feature called Meetings. Now, Meetings enables us to host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. And with Meetings and all the other benefits of RingCentral, that all together makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the market today. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 a month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. And they have a special offer for our listeners of Tech News Today. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number designated for TWIT, 800-543-9980. I'll give that to you again, 800-543-9980. Or you can just go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT.
Pretty surprising.
Well, Google's director of network engineering, whose name is Jeffrey Bergen, wrote a blog post yesterday about Google Fiber. He said that Google doesn't charge companies to prioritize packets the way that Comcast and other ISPs do. Google Fiber is the company's ultra-high-speed internet service, which, although it gets a lot of press, is currently available only in Kansas City and in Provo, Utah. John Brodkin is a senior reporter for Ars Technica and wrote a really cool piece about this. Welcome, John.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So what is Bergen's blog post all about, and why do you think he wrote it at this time?
Well, first of all, it's not for prioritization of traffic. It's for that implies that, you know, they're speeding up traffic on the last mile of the network, you know, faster than other traffic goes. That's not what they're doing. What they're actually doing is taking Netflix storage boxes and putting them inside their network so that there is fewer hops for the traffic to go through. And then it goes along, you know, at the same speed as anything else would go after that. They've been partnering with Netflix for a while because Netflix, they have tried to get as many ISPs on board as possible because they want to have these direct connections and not have to pay for them. But Comcast and other companies like Verizon and AT&T have wanted Netflix to instead pay for these connections. Interestingly, Google, obviously, they're not just an ISP. They're a video provider, too, with YouTube. And we don't know for sure, but they probably already pay Comcast and Verizon for connections. But they've never complained about it publicly. So this is kind of a backdoor way of complaining about it and supporting Netflix's argument, because Netflix is trying to hop on this net neutrality bandwagon and ask the FCC to outlaw payments for peering, which have never been outlawed before.
Right.
It's not just YouTube, by the way, right? I mean, Google, we use Chromecast here in my house. And Google is in the same business that Apple and Amazon and Netflix is in. They stream video from Google Play. So it's that
right.
too.
Yeah, it's just that YouTube is the second biggest source of traffic on the internet in North America. It's like 13% of peak traffic, whereas Netflix is 34%. And that's not including all of the other Google services.
Mm-hmm. Now, John Brodkin, you know, there are a bunch of terms that have been flying around related to the Comcast and Netflix relationship, related to net neutrality. And some of these are really kind of confusing to the public. For example, there's paid peering. That's one phrase. Another one is prioritization. Yet another one is paid prioritization, which can be different from prioritization. And, of course, there's co-location. Now, you mentioned that Google is very much in favor of co-location, in fact, does that with Netflix and other you know, high-bandwidth providers. And as I understand it, Google's in favor of everything that doesn't give certain types of traffic priority over other types of traffic, and they're also not in favor of any sort of payments for this stuff. They believe that all the companies involved should set up whatever connections are necessary to give the fastest traffic to deliver some of the bigger high bandwidth content like YouTube, like Netflix, to customers without any money changing hands. Is that essentially their position?
Yeah, I think so. And the idea is that customers, you know, people like me who are watching Netflix, we're already paying our ISP for certain amount of bandwidth, and we're requesting Netflix traffic, and Netflix has built out a network that it paid for, and so there shouldn't be another fee that Netflix pays the ISPs, because essentially both sides are already getting paid for the traffic. The thing that makes it problematic in a lot of people's view is that, you know, the ISP market is so uncompetitive. You know, Comcast has something like 20 million customers, and most people can't switch because there isn't a viable competitor. So essentially Comcast can charge whatever it wants. And
can I play devil's advocate here, though, just for one second?
Sure.
I mean, I kind of take Google's side. You know, the internet's supposed to be sort of a free medium. But to the point you just made, which was in some neighborhoods, there's only one provider. And in some cases, that infrastructure is just not up to the task of supporting everything that the users are asking for. And so at some point, to provide everybody with the best possible experience, they have to maybe throttle what's going on in order to, you know, Netflix is compromising some other application, let's say. So what about that part of it? I mean, not everybody gets Google Fiber to their doorstep.
Yeah, but I don't think that's where the throttling there isn't throttling, but that's not where it's happening. See, there was Netflix was performing really poorly on Comcast, not because of any degradation of the infrastructure on the so-called last mile, which is the point from which traffic enters the ISP's network until the point it hits a consumer's home. All of the congestion was taking place outside of that point where Comcast was exchanging traffic with with the providers that Netflix were paying to distribute their traffic. Now, when Netflix started paying Comcast for direct connection, those connections, which again are on the outskirts of the network, suddenly they had enough capacity because Comcast upgraded them. So the problem was solved without any of the last mile infrastructure being upgraded.
Now, just one last question about co-location. Can you sort of tell us how that works exactly? And I understand that there's, you know, so let's say, for example, Google Fiber uses co-location with Netflix. I think Bergen mentioned that actually in his post. And yes. So there are Netflix servers inside the Google Fiber facility. How does that, do they essentially have a copy of every movie that Netflix offers? How does that work exactly, co-location?
Yeah, exactly. They have storage boxes. They're called caches inside the ISP's network. And Netflix can store its entire North American catalog in like one or two racks of servers. And that's, you know, a lot of data. It's like a terabyte. And they usually have two copies just in case one of them goes down. But the idea is you've got the video right inside the ISP's network, so you don't have to bring it from outside the network. It's one less step that it has to go through, and it avoids the congested links that are often that, you know, exist between Comcast and some other ISPs.
Now, John, do you think we're going to get to a point where we have co-location inside our house? For example, I'd love to have a box on my TV that has, you know, I don't know, 50 terabytes of data or something like that, and basically have everything Netflix has and then essentially unlock it or, you know, whatever they want to do to charge me for it. But that's really becoming possible because of the cost of storage, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, Netflix suggested this because what they could do is have users download videos and they could turn it into a peer-to-peer network where I could actually store a video in my house, and then it becomes part of a peer-to-peer network, which would be very much like BitTorrent, where other Netflix users can get video from me. They sort of, this is almost like a threat to the ISPs because the ISPs argue, well, if you're sending more traffic to us than we send to you, you should pay. But if they did this, if I, as a Netflix user, was the one sending traffic, then they could reverse it so that the traffic is going in the other direction, and then Netflix could argue, well, then now you should pay us. But they actually are serious about it to an extent. They're hiring engineers to work on some kind of peer-to-peer video distribution protocol. I don't think this is ever, or at least in the next 5 years, going to become the primary way that Netflix video is distributed, but it could, you know, if people are interested in it, they can sort of opt in once Netflix offered this, and they could store video in their homes.
Well, I hope that day comes sooner rather than later. That sounds like the way to go, especially when we get into 4K content, which is just really way too huge to try to squeeze through Comcast in any sort of timely way. John Brodkin, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today and telling us about all this.
Thanks for having me.
All right, you can find John Brodkin at arstechnica.com and on Twitter at jbrodkin. Well, Google plans to sell Wi-Fi hardware and software cheaply to small and medium-sized business, according to an exclusive by Amira Frati on the tech news site The Information. Google would also share customer data with the companies that would help them run their businesses better. The catch? Well, Google may require the companies to log in to their Google accounts and accept targeted advertising from Google. Small and medium-sized businesses, welcome to the club. This is how they monetize things. The new program could launch as early as this summer. Now, David Berlind, this is kind of an interesting version of Google Fiber. Google basically gets paid when people use the internet more. And so they're trying to help small and medium-sized businesses use the internet more, have higher bandwidth, and they're subsidizing, it sounds like, Wi-Fi hardware and software, and they're trying to monetize it with advertising. This sounds like an interesting new model for Google. What do you think about this?
I really think that what they do is they try to monetize the information they have. That's just an extension of what they've always done. I'll give you an example, and you probably are aware of this running the website there. Way back, Google decided that they were going to close off all the information that was coming from Google Search that was coming into your site. So, right, you know, whereas before I used to be able to tell I can see what traffic is coming from Google search, but I could also see the search term, right? Then they stopped that. But if you're paying for advertising on Google, AdWords and that sort of thing, then they didn't stop that. You got to see the information, so they passed it through. And so I think this is just an extension of that business model where Google is saying, look, we have a ton of information that we can share with our customers, but the quid pro quo is that they're going to have to pay for it. Yeah. Simple as that.
Yep. And of course, this has not been announced by Google. We don't know for sure that this is going to actually exist in real life. This is based on documents that Amir Afradi got his hands on and also an unnamed source. So we'll look for that, and hopefully if they do come out with it, it'll come out by the end of the summer, and we'll report it here on Tech News Today. Well, Apple may be finally getting the message, even if some users aren't getting the message. The company's iMessage system has been causing problems for users who switch from an iPhone to a non-iPhone. The trouble is that Apple still lists the numbers in iMessage account, so messages get trapped in an iMessage purgatory where they can't escape. Sounds terrifying for the messages.
Well, everything gets trapped in some purgatory when you decide to switch platforms. It's just a bunch of walled gardens at this point. It's not the open internet anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people start using SMS through iMessage. And of course, a recent server glitch made the problem worse, and there's even a lawsuit around this. And Apple told Recode's Ina Fried today that they fixed a server-side bug, and they're going to offer another bug fix in a future update that should address the problem. But this is something that I've been reading about this for, I don't know, a week or two, and Apple didn't really respond to the whole problem until the complaints reached a big crescendo. So I think part of the problem is that Apple is probably giving low priority to the people who must be insane to switch from an iPhone to a non-iPhone. You'd have to be nuts. What kind of people are these?
Did it a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. So did I. Hey, wow! Look at that. Your background—you're actually in the Twit Studios now. That's a miracle of green screen technology.
Actually, just a miracle of NASA. They managed to land me next to your offices, and I was able to kind of walk in. And Jason sat me down in a nice, comfortable seat here. So nice to look across the room at you here.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the side effect was that you're now gigantic. So, oh well. What are you going to do?
I'm larger than life.
All right. You've got a new basketball career.
Yeah.
Well, the Chinese government announced today that it'll inspect technology products coming into the country for both national security and, quote, economic and social development reasons, unquote. In other words, China wants to punish America for charging 5 employees of the Chinese army with cyber espionage. Companies that don't pass the inspection process will be banned from sale in China. What goes around comes around. David Berlind, and these are basically economic sanctions on the United States, where China is threatening to, and they probably will, punish American technology companies because the U.S. government is trying to charge people in the Chinese army with cyber espionage, which, of course, almost certainly took place. And, of course, they almost certainly did steal intellectual property from American companies, and they almost certainly gave them to Chinese companies to give them an advantage in either negotiations or also in the international marketplace for technology. But the United States, of course, thanks to Edward Snowden, we know that the U.S. Routinely does massive mass surveillance and hacking and spying for the purpose primarily of anti-terrorism and for crime purposes. And there's
not to mention the strategic placement of a Trojan horse or two in the infrastructure that we sell to to Chinese, you know, companies and stuff like that.
Well,
right?
That's it exactly. The fact is that they will find actual evidence of NSA snooping in the products that they inspect. They almost certainly will find those.
Oh my God!
And so, you know,
Right.
It's yet another problem here that I think is underappreciated in the conversations around all this spying, which is that the Chinese government is really big into hacking. The U.S. government is really big into hacking. The difference is that the Chinese government's hacking benefits the Chinese economy, and the U.S. hacking benefits the Chinese economy harms the U.S. economy.
Here's a question I have. If China flew some planes over Silicon Valley and dropped a bunch of bombs on the businesses in Silicon Valley and then flew away, we would call that an act of war. So what is it when China essentially drops some other kind of bomb on those companies, a cyber warfare type of bomb? It's not an act of war? I mean, at what point are we not at war or at war with countries that conduct cyber warfare? And at what point are they at war or not at war with us? Because we're doing the same thing. I don't get it. I mean, does it even matter to declare war anymore? I guess that's the question I'm asking.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I do believe that the Chinese government sees economic health, economic wealth as a national security issue in a way that the United States doesn't. And you can see that the way the U.S. And the NSA in particular felt free to exploit U.S. technology companies and put U.S. technology companies at risk and at an international disadvantage to do its hacking. And so there's a different fundamental difference of opinion. And to a certain extent, I think the Chinese have it right. You really have much better national security if your economy is very strong. And my personal belief is that the U.S. government, the NSA in particular, should spend a lot more time protecting U.S. companies from cyber espionage. I mean, I don't think that, you know, most businesses in the U.S. have the means to really protect themselves from sophisticated Chinese hacking and industrial espionage. But the NSA does, and they need to change their focus and to protect U.S. businesses and stop exploiting them so that they can have this, like, unlimited amount of access to all communication everywhere in the world, no matter where it occurs. I think that it requires a refocusing, and the intentions of the NSA, the mission of the NSA, needs to be balanced against other American interests instead of just ignoring all other American interests and just going after what they want, which is all information all the time of all communication. So
yeah, I think there's a case to be made for what you're saying if you follow what's recently been going on with Russia and the economic warfare that, in the way of sanctions that we've been imposing on Russia as a result of their incursion into the Ukraine, the damage has been pretty wide. The financial damage, the damage to Russia's financial system, has been pretty profound, and it just goes to show when you have certain economic strength, the sort of punishment or that you can mete out from that position of strength. If you undermine that economic strength, it weakens your strategic position in the world community.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Well, LG plans to introduce a phone next week with a totally unusual feature. The LG G3 has a phone case with a round cutout for displaying what is essentially smartwatch functionality directly on the phone. With just a small part of the screen visible, users can see notifications and other information and also do simple tasks like making calls, controlling music, and using the camera without opening the case. It's essentially a smartwatch affixed to the phone, and only that part of the screen, of course, is activated when this case is displayed. The irony is that, of course, LG's actual smartwatch is going to be square, not round. But this looks like it could be an Android Wear-type device. Do you think this kind of gimmick is going to help LG in the market, David Berland?
You know, I have never been a really good judge of what works in the market and what doesn't. Every time I say something's going to fall flat on its face, it turns out to be a big hit. And when I see something that I think is going to be a big hit, it falls flat on its face. So I guess, you know, my number one concern when it comes to any sort of product like this is the extent to which it interoperates with other devices. So, okay, it's a watch that's designed to work with Android. Will it work with any Android phone? You know, it's that sort of thing. In looking at what you just showed on the screen here, my sense is no, this is sort of an integrated thing that's only going to work on the LG platform. So therefore, it limits the market to only those people who own LG phones, and maybe it'll drive some interest in LG phones. But what really drives interest for me is, you know, when I can mix and match my products. So,
yeah. Well, speaking of Russia, in other news, the Russian government launched a new Sputnik today. That's the name of the Kremlin's new search engine, developed by the state-owned company Rostelecom. The Google alternative was reportedly developed at a cost of $42 million, which is less than what Google co-founder Sergey Brin paid for his yacht.
That's the same as 28,000 copies of Google Glass, by the way. I did the math.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The Sputnik search engine will thoroughly censor the internet to Vladimir Putin's exacting specifications, at least for the zero people who use it. Why do countries like Russia do this kind of thing? Who's going to use a search engine developed by the Kremlin? I mean, come on.
It's a spying mechanism. Come on. What else could it be?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to close the show in just a sec, but first I want to talk to you about Gazelle. Gazelle is the place that will buy your used gadgets. And you want to sell your used gadgets to them, too, because they're not doing you any good in a drawer or in a box or wherever they are in your house. They're just wasting away and losing value. So here's what you do. You go to Gazelle, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Choose your phone from the options available. Tell them what condition it's in, and they'll give you a price. And they'll pay you fast by check, by PayPal, or the best option, in my opinion, is the Amazon gift card option, because they'll give you 5% more money for your device. And that's really the way to go. They'll send you a free box. They'll address the whole thing for you. You don't have to do anything other than put your phone in the box, put the sticker on the outside of the box, and hand it back to your mailman. And off it goes, and soon you'll get paid very fast. No hassles at all. It's super easy to do. I've done it myself multiple times. It's always a really pleasant experience. In fact, Google's paid more than $100 million to over 700,000 customers. And I believe that Gazelle is an environmentally friendly company because they put phones back into circulation, which means that there's a brand new phone that doesn't have to be manufactured out there somewhere. And that is good for the environment. So you, if your phone is still functioning, and even if it's broken, they'll buy it, put it back into circulation. They'll wipe it completely to take your data off of it, get it in great shape, and then they're going to sell it to somebody somewhere, and they can get value out of that phone. So it's really a great thing for everyone. So find out what your Apple or Android device is worth, and take a minute, go to gazelle.com and find out. Do it now, because your device may lose value the longer you wait. So you want to go back to something, David?
No, I'm sorry. I thought you were done there when I interrupted. I want to go back to the point you made earlier with Ring Central. You said that Leo doesn't like to build old and busted stuff. I'm very surprised to hear that. I mean, most of the people I associate with prefer to build old and busted stuff.
Really? Well, who have you been associating with? You've been working with the government again, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, come on. Doesn't everybody like to build old and busted stuff? That's the way it should be.
Okay, so if you're looking at the video right now, just ignore what you're seeing, please. This is not actually happening. It's an incredible simulation. Well, David Berlin, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News Today. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I hope you'll have me back again.
And your background, that was quite an adventure. It's almost like Tyson's, what's his name, the physicist?
We'll be doing this again.
Yeah,
sure.
We'll be doing this again.
Yeah, Jason breathing down your neck there.
If you could put put a weather map behind me, I can try that out too.
So there's the little devil. Now you need an angel on the other shoulder to give you good advice.
And she better be an angel. That's all I can say.
Oh, brother. Speaking of angels, Natalie Morris is on the show tomorrow as our guest co-anchor. And also all next week. We're off on Monday, but she'll be here Tuesday through Friday next week and tomorrow. Again, thank you, David Berlin. By the way, where can people find your work, David Berlin?
Thank you for asking. You can find my work on programmableweb.com. It's a site that's dedicated to the art of web development, particularly when you're using APIs. And if you happen to be in San Francisco next week and want to see our big conference, APIcon, it's going on starting on Tuesday, APIconsf.com.
Wonderful. And of course, you're on Twitter at dberlind. That's D followed by the name of the German city, followed by another D.
That's how I say it all the time.
All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
We want you to subscribe to Tech News Today. It's a fantastic idea, and there are millions of ways. Well, not millions. There are probably a couple dozen ways to subscribe based on your favorite service, including RSS. Just go to twit.tv/TNT, and you'll find all the options there, and you can go ahead and subscribe. We'll just come right to you. We also want to hear from you, so send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific, tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. See you tomorrow.